Hello and welcome to Behind the News, not yet profiled in The Guardian. My name is Doug Henwood. The standard duo today, Jake Werner, will outline a progressive policy towards China, and Gabriel Hetland will review the tenure of Gustavo Petro, the guerrilla-turned-politician who recently completed his second year in office. These days, it seems like almost everyone across the political spectrum hates China. It's a major human rights offender and job stealer scheming to dominate the world and topple the U.S. from doing so. While there are no angels, to steal a phrase, reality is, of course, more complicated, and jacking up tensions with a rising superpower seems rather unwise. Jake Werner, who was on this show in January 2020 talking about the folly of Trump's trade war with that country, is just out with a paper co-published by the Quincy Institute, the Institute for Policy Studies, and Justices Global, called A Program for Progressive China Policy. He is acting director of the East Asia Program at the Quincy Institute, and a co-founder of Justices Global, Jake Werner. We may not like China's human rights practices, but are they hell-bent on world domination, as people like to say? Much of the U.S. political class seems to think so, in both parties. Is that a fair characterization?
I think it's just an inaccurate characterization. The Chinese government has been very cautious. I'm sure that they would like to dominate the world if they feel like they could. They recognize the limitations of their position in the system. They recognize the sort of constraints that they are under domestically and internationally. They have a real investment in maintaining certain parts of the global status quo because it has worked so well for them, and they don't want to destabilize that. They certainly do want to change some parts of the global system, but they do not want to take it over. And I think that's actually quite clear if you look at a place like the Middle East, where there is an opening for China to significantly increase its influence. And for the most part, it has declined to do so, particularly in the realm of military and security. They look at what the United States has done over the last 20 and 30 years, and basically they say, yeah, we don't want any part of that.
But it does seem like China is a popular scapegoat, one for the erosion of American power globally, but also for economic troubles. Now, you point out that China managed a more successful recovery from the 2008 crisis that the U.S. did, which is, I think, an underappreciated fact. How does that affect relations between the two countries?
I think more or less what's motivating American leaders to have this view of China as being a sinister actor trying to displace U.S. power, as they say, is a crisis of self-confidence on the part of American leaders. That starting with the 2008 crisis, even before that, really, with the failures of free trade and under the Bush administration and the failures in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then the denouement was the 2008 crisis and the failure of the American economy to recover. And as a result, the emergence of populist politics and what seemed to be the collapse of legitimacy on the part of what had previously been mainstream political leadership. These people in the Biden administration, mainstream Republicans, they were, I think, really wrong-footed. They didn't really understand why suddenly they could no longer rule the world like they felt like they had been just 10 years prior. And they were looking around for explanations. And China seemed to offer that explanation because it did recover much faster coming out of the 2008 crisis. Although in order to do so, it had to inflate its own property bubble that was very dangerous. And the Chinese leadership knew it was very dangerous. They didn't have this false sense of confidence that the American leadership had as the American property bubble was going up. But China recovered quickly. It seemed to be driving the global economy. It seemed to be increasing its diplomatic and economic power everywhere. It was starting to compete with American businesses that previously had just been able to supply China. And then as the sort of global crisis of democracy developed, China has always been the symbol of autocracy for Americans. And so it seemed like China could also be blamed for the crisis of democratic legitimacy that was happening worldwide. China didn't really have that much to do with any of the problems that the United States was suffering in the 2010s, but it did offer an explanation. And maybe more importantly, it offered a focal point around which American leaders could build an action agenda to feel like they were doing something against all these setbacks.
Well, there is the line that China stole our jobs, which Trump is certainly making a lot of hay out of, but Democrats play that game too. So what about that job theft indictment?
I think there's a deeper problem with the line, which is that really every worker in the world should have a decent job. So we shouldn't be pitting Chinese workers and American workers against each other in that way. But there is also the analytical question. It is certainly true that much of the deindustrialization that happened in the first two decades of the 21st century in the United States was related to the growth of the industrial economy in China. But this process started long, long before that. It started in the 70s. You can even see it starting in the 60s as you get deindustrialization in the American North, jobs start to move to the South. But certainly by the 70s and 80s, deindustrialization was already underway. China sort of provided a way for American business leaders to seek out cheaper labor, to use that as a threat against their workers, to accept lower wages and worse working conditions. China provided that function, but China can't really be blamed for that, particularly because what else was it supposed to do? That was the only way you could succeed in the global economy that we had in the aughts and the 2010s. I think that global economy was unjust, and we should be looking for a different kind of global economy, but then we would need to offer that to developing countries rather than just blaming them for doing what they could to get decent jobs and development.
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember when Japan was the culprit for stealing our jobs. Underlying a lot of this, though, is a change in the relative status of the countries. China is no longer a low-wage, low-skilled workshop that it once was. They've gone from stuffing printed circuit boards to designing the chips that go into them. American elites find that disturbing, and they've been able to bring along some of the American population as well. They find it disturbing for military, political, and economic reasons. How to manage this status anxiety?
Yeah, this is a real problem. It is a political and economic problem, a military problem. It's also, I think, a cultural and racial problem. This is the first time that a country that was not one of the colonial powers that has really broken through and moved into the ranks of the top powers since the 19th century. So this is both confusing and threatening at multiple levels to American leaders. The way that this has to be managed is we have to create enough space for both countries to be successful. Not everyone's going to be satisfied by that. Certainly, hardcore nationalists and militarists in both countries want confrontation because it makes them more powerful. But I think the regular people in both countries and business elites in both countries and the sort of liberal-minded politicians in both countries could get on board with a system that had enough space for both countries to thrive in high-value sectors. So that's why I really emphasize the need to focus on reforming the global economy so that we get faster growth and more equitable growth, which would also restore some of the lost legitimacy of the global economy. That fundamentally has to be done through increasing the power of labor to demand its share of production and increasing the level of productivity raising development investment in the global economy so that there's enough to go around for everybody.
Yeah, I want to get to the constructive parts a little bit, but let's touch on a few more of the sore spots. What has the effect been of Trump's tariffs and then Biden's continuing them on relations between the two countries?
There was a lot of speculation about whether this would be a serious economic setback for China. It turned out not to be. China found other markets. It has only grown faster and entered further high-value sectors since the tariffs started. So it hasn't been an economic problem, but it was really the tariffs and the Trump administration's attempt to destroy Huawei, which is the most successful multinational Chinese business, those two together really signaled to the Chinese leadership that the United States was now treating China as an enemy. And the fact that the Biden administration continued those policies and built on them and made them even more threatening by bringing on U.S. allies, that really confirmed for the Chinese leadership that both parties are determined to prevent China from growing in wealth and status. The trade war, even though economically it was less disruptive than many people feared, nonetheless, the politics has really made the relationship toxic, and we have yet to recover from that.
Biden's industrial policy, such as it is, has been partly justified by mobilizing against China. Is that really a good idea?
No, I don't think that's a good idea. There are certainly are people who just want to break the stranglehold of free market ideology and are willing to kind of use any means at hand to do so. And I can see a case for that. I just think that if you're progressive-minded about this, if your goal is human welfare, when you break the stranglehold of free market economics in that way, what you're going to get is an institutionalization of the use of the state in the economy for great power conflict and geopolitical competition and military confrontation rather than an economy that's devoted towards meeting the needs of regular people. And I think that's the direction that we're headed on. A lot of people, because China has been this sort of punching bag for decades, And it didn't seem to have any consequences. A lot of people are very complacent about what the outcome of this is going to be. Now that China is the second most powerful country in the world, it is the most important trading country in the world, is increasingly important in global investment. To alienate China in this way is going to have terrible consequences for the global economy, for security and military issues, for human rights and democracy. So I am very worried that that Democrats in particular have been using China as the reason that they want to increase the role of the state in the economy.
As a student of elites, I'm struck by the contrast between the two countries' ruling classes. Ours seems very short-term, unable to think beyond, I don't know, the next election cycle, the next quarterly earnings cycle, whatever. Whereas the Chinese elites seem to be capable of really thinking in long-term, planning over the course of decades or more. What do you think of that?
I think the contrast is not quite as big as it seems at first. I might reposition that idea that in both countries, the elites had been short-term in the kind of high neoliberal era. There's a lot of reliance on the market and faith that market reform would take care of these sorts of things. We don't need to worry about planning because the market will take us there. And for the Chinese elite, it was a question of how to introduce those reforms in a gradual way so it didn't destabilize their political hold. But the faith fundamentally was in the market. And there was a belief on the Chinese side as well as the American side that the two countries were converging towards this free market utopia until it all fell apart after 2008. And what we've seen since 2008, I think, is the uneven emergence of an ability to think long-term on the part of elites. And I think you see that very clearly in China with the more and more ambitious industrial policy, more and more successfully breaking into sectors that China had no production capacity in. And now China is in a position to dominate many of these sectors, particularly in the green economy. But I think you see it in the Biden administration as well. It's this the idea that the state would be used to pursue industrial policy in the interests of the public, which is the stated reason that the Biden administration is pursuing this stuff. I think we're seeing the emergence of kind of a cadre of state officials who can think in longer terms, even if the kind of institutional constraints in the American political system are making that process very uneven in the American case, and it is coming together more clearly in the Chinese case. But we also shouldn't underestimate the continuing fragmentation and contradictions within the Chinese economy that constantly create problems, short-term emergencies that Chinese leaders need to deal with. Even as they have this capacity for planning, they also are constantly putting out fires. And the Chinese path towards these long-term goals is very unstable, and that's a source of anxiety on the Chinese side as well.
I'm speaking with Jake Werner, author of a paper on a progressive China policy. You constantly hear China bears in the West saying, oh, yeah, this now they're about to fall apart. You know, the credit's too extended, too many bubbles all over the place, overcapacity, you know, and it's all going to collapse. What do you think of that?
We shouldn't underestimate the serious structural problems in the Chinese economy. At the same time, I think it's unlikely that the Chinese economy is going to collapse. The fact that they did recover from the 2008 crisis, primarily by inflating a gigantic real estate bubble, that meant that they have had to deal with this. Every time they tried to bring the bubble down from 2008 until 2020, 2021, it looked like they were going to start a crisis and then they pulled back from the brink. It was really only during the pandemic that the leadership took the step of really committed to, we're going to bring this bubble down now and we're going to replace it by this high value manufacturing economy. And that has yet to be proven a success, but they have really made significant advances along that line. Now, that's introducing, I think, very serious tensions internationally, because nobody but China really wants China to dominate the entire advanced manufacturing sector. So that's creating new problems, but I wouldn't dismiss the ability of the Chinese leadership to pull this off. At the same time, they are really facing these serious problems, and they're very reluctant to pursue some of the steps that would address, at least in the short term, some of the problems like a shortfall in consumer demand. So it's a little bit of both, but I certainly wouldn't jump on the China is collapsing bandwagon until we see something much more serious than what we've seen over the last couple of years.
Okay, now let's switch to the more constructive side of your analysis here, ways to ratchet down the tensions. You talk some about global trade rules and reforming those, loosen restrictions on the two IPs, industrial policy and intellectual property. You talk about those things and how they would help improve life.
One of the sort of darkly comical aspects of the U.S.-China conflict is that both sides are kind of moving in the same direction. They both are increasingly appreciating the role of the state in the economy and using it to cement their geopolitical position, and doing so with an attempt to dominate high-value so-called industries of the future, what they imagine to be high-value industries of the future anyway. They're really both pursuing industrial policy in broadly similar ways, and yet the way they talk about what they're doing is completely different from the way they talk about what the other side is doing. So the United States says, China, when China pursues industrial policy, it's violating the sacred market. And when we pursue industrial policy, we're actually perfecting the market. And actually, China says the same thing, but in reverse about the United States. China has brought a complaint at the WTO against the Inflation Reduction Act, saying that this violates the free market principles of the WTO. And they say, what we're doing is actually in line with market forces. We're just providing market demand, and we have a comparative advantage in these fields. So both sides are doing the same thing, and they're saying they're doing completely different things. And unfortunately, the thing that they say they're doing is in line with free market ideology. So I think this is very unhealthy in the bilateral relationship, and it's also very unhealthy for the way that we think about how we move beyond a neoliberal economy. And I would much rather both sides recognize that they're basically doing the same thing. They're doing it for similar reasons, because there were serious problems with neoliberalism. And then they say, not only are we going to accept what the other side is doing, but we're going to allow other countries that are not strong enough to break these rules with abandon to pursue industrial policy in the same way. And so that sort of articulates an agenda of reform for global economic rules that would make industrial policy available to developing countries and to other countries that, and potentially to Europe as well, although they really are the last sort of free market ideology holdouts. Then I think the other question that you raised was about intellectual property. This is somewhat different. China started out at the bottom of the manufacturing food chain, and the United States at the top. The United States implemented a very strict regime of intellectual property restrictions through WTO rules in the 1990s, and that has effectively prevented developing countries from making a breakthrough in development ever since, with the exception of China. And China did it because they were able to break these rules. I would like to recognize the fact that China was sort of forced into what I think is a set of unhealthy behaviors, but they were forced into those behaviors by the restrictions on development that free market globalization imposed. I think we should recognize that, and then we should, again, reform these rules, liberalize them, so that it is easier for technology to be diffused and for developing countries to gain access to the means of wealth production. I think that would make the global economy richer. It would certainly hurt some rent seekers, but it would make the global economy richer and more efficient, more dynamic. And that would help people, I think, in the rich countries and the poor countries alike.
This would be a serious departure from the trade regime we've seen over the last couple of decades, though.
Yes, 100%. But I think that certainly as China moves into position at the top of technology in areas like battery technology, it may be that American leaders can suddenly recognize that it's not so bad if they get access to intellectual property that they themselves have not developed. So I think there is a case to be made that is in the self-interest of American business, as well as in the interests of global development and a more equitable global economy.
Of course, the Chinese may discover the charms of intellectual property restrictions as they get higher and higher.
They have been moving in that direction, unfortunately. This is the time to intervene and try to shift this in a more productive direction.
And you talk also about development investment in poorer countries. What do you have in mind there?
Going back to that idea that we have to open up space for all countries to grow, or else we're going to get pulled into zero-sum conflict over who can seize what little growth is available. The countries with the greatest potential for growth are those that are currently the poorest countries. In order to make good on that potential, though, we need to draw in far, far more capital in a way that can change the productive landscape in the developing countries. And I think the U.S. and China actually are well positioned to do that if they could envision this as a joint project. But it would require, I think, just in the interests of the future of humanity, we require huge investment in the climate transition in the developing countries. This is something that the U.S. and China have been fighting over rather than getting together to achieve. But that sort of provides a model for a wider set of development policies that I think could be pursued that would move much of the surplus capital that is sitting unproductively in the rich countries and in China into places that could really transform the possibilities for production and wages and productivity in the developing countries in ways that would create enough space for everybody to be able to thrive at the same time.
It does seem that global climate policies would be much better off if the two countries could cooperate rather than feud.
Yes. More or less what they're doing right now is they're using each other as a scapegoat. There have been some climate discussions that have been productive, but in very, very small ways. And so the ambition really needs to be increased. And I think the coordination around supporting the climate transition in the global south is a place that aligns with other interests that the two countries have that would make use of complementarities between the two countries. There's a lot of potential room to make progress here.
And finally, the human rights question. People love to accuse China of severe human rights violations, and there's certainly some justification for that claim. The U.S. is, of course, happy to overlook human rights violations in third countries to recruit allies to the anti-China cause. But how does the international environment affect Chinese human rights policies?
The Chinese government is guilty of terrible human rights violations in the case of some forms of ethnic repression rising to the level of crimes against humanity. But, of course, that doesn't make it unique in the world. There are many U.S. allies, and the United States itself is engaged in war crimes and crimes against humanity. The question for me is not how are we going to sort of get all of the most powerful people in the world before a court that can pass judgment on them. That's just not realistic in the world we live in. The question for me is how do we use the interests of these people to create an accommodating environment for progressive change? And to me, there are possibilities there. First of all, there are major threats because the worse international tensions get, the worse that military confrontation gets, the better that kind of a landscape is for the most reactionary people in the world. It's precisely the nationalists and the militarists and the nativists on both sides that love that kind of confrontational environment. And it's precisely that kind of an environment that systematically marginalizes people who want to criticize injustice inside their society and who want to reduce the level of inequality and exploitation in their own country and in the world. The first thing is just to say we have to find a constructive relationship between the U.S. and China simply to reduce some of the pressures that are going to bring to power the most reactionary people in these two countries. But if we're able to get to a constructive relationship between the two countries, I think there could be progress along these issues in the global economy, on climate, on global governance, that could create a much more welcoming environment for human rights movements and democratization movements in the United States and in China and in other countries around the world. I don't think the U.S.-China relationship is going to itself achieve these things, but I think the U.S.-China relationship could create the conditions under which we could have a new democracy movement globally, and hopefully one that is less superficial than the voting rights and free speech that dominated the neoliberal era. We need a much deeper democratization of society so that people are included in a substantive way rather than just through these formal rules and freedoms.
That was Jake Werner, acting director of the East Asia Program at the Quincy Institute. His paper, A Program for Progressive China Policy, no indefinite article, can be found on the Quincy website. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. That was some of the third movement of Beethoven's Piano Trio No. 3, performed by Daniel Barenboim, Jacqueline Dupre, and Pinchas Zukerman. Next, Gustavo Petro's record as president of Colombia, a country with a very reactionary ruling class, even by Latin American standards, and a very long history of conservative governance. That long history was disrupted in 2022 with the election of the left-winger Gustavo Petro to the presidency. Petro joined the M19 guerrilla movement as a teenager in the 1970s. He was arrested in 1987 and during his confinement changed his mind about armed struggle and entered politics. He and some former comrades formed an M19 Democratic Alliance, and he ran successfully for the country's Chamber of Deputies, where he served from 1991 to 2006. He then won election to the country's Senate, and following that, the mayoralty of Bogotá, and then he went back to the Senate before being elected president in 2022. How has he done governing this deeply conservative country? Here with some answers is Gabriel Hetland, author of an article on that topic in The Nation. He's an associate professor of Latin American, Caribbean, and Latinx studies at the University of Albany, a.k.a. SUNY Albany. He was on this show last year to discuss his book, Democracy on the Ground, a study of the role of local politics in Latin America's left turn. Apologies for the brief eruption of canine background vocals. Gabriel Hetland. Gustavo Petro made a remarkable transition from guerrilla to politician. How did that happen?
So he entered, you know, in his teen years into a sort of urban guerrilla faction, and there was a pacification, like peace process demobilization in the 1980s and really early 1990s. And Petro participated in that, converted it into a political party, ran for office. He was in the Congress and then in the Senate. And there was this new constitution in 1991, which had some progressive elements of it. And I think there was just the guerrilla struggle didn't bear fruit. It didn't work out. And so Petro tried this new strategy of politics. And it certainly has worked out better for him, and I'd say more or less better for Colombia. I mean, the guerrilla struggle in Colombia has not been particularly fruitful in terms of leading to positive change. And so then Petro was mayor of Bogotá. That's when he sort of became particularly prominent in the early 2010s, and then ran for president initially in 2018, came in second, and then ended up winning the presidency in the second round in 2022.
His predecessors, Uribe, has been quite an influence from the right. Is he still exerting any kind of influence?
I think his influence is more limited recently. So he was president in the early 2000s, and he was very influential until just before Petro. So Iván Duque was the president of Colombia, elected in 2018, the guy who beat Petro. And he succeeded Juan Manuel Santos, who was a successor of Uribe, but broke with Uribe, and Santos actually was a conservative leader who did this peace agreement with the FARC, won a Nobel Prize. I'm not sure he quite deserved it, but he was, you know, interesting. I mean, he wasn't a sort of classic Uribista, but then Duque came back, and that was sort of, you know, Uribe basically coming back into office, or Uribismo coming back into office, really hard version of neoliberalism, and that was really rejected. So there's an interesting period before Petro gets elected. There's something called the Estallido Social, or the social uprising in 2021, which is a rejection of some tax reforms that Uribe was, Duque, Uribe's sort of, you know, one of his successors and very close to Uribe, was implementing, and the economy wasn't doing particularly well based on the pandemic, and a huge general strike across the country lasting, I think, like over a month in much of the country, and that set the groundwork for Petro to actually win in 2022. I think if you look at Latin America and the pink tide, where you've seen these leftist governments elected, you know, in Venezuela, Brazil, all over. Colombia was an exception to that. They had not joined the pink tide at all. And then finally, in 2022, the left was able to break through. So it's a really unique moment in Colombia's history.
Petro doesn't have a majority in Congress. So how has he been able to govern so far?
It's been hard, undoubtedly hard. So when he got elected in 2022, he didn't have a majority in Congress, so he's never had a majority. He has the Historic Pact, which is a coalition of left and center-left forces that are, you know, it's not a political party, it's a coalition of a bunch of different parties and political forces. And even they don't have a majority. So Petro formed a majority by bringing in centrist and even some conservative political parties into his government in August 2022. And that sort of government lasted through April 2023. And they were able to pass a fairly progressive tax reform. And then there was a peace plan, the Total Peace Initiative, which passed in November 2022. And then Petro tried to pass a whole bunch of reforms all at once. It was kind of like, let me hit them with everything all at once. And that just split the coalition apart. And so since April 2023, Petro has been operating as a minority government with Congress. And so he doesn't have any support. And so he's still been able to pass a couple things, but it's been a really hard slog. And to pass anything, he's had to really compromise quite significantly.
There was a half-decent pension reform, right?
Yes, the pension reform just passed in June. And it's, yeah, I think half-decent is exactly right. So it's not the most progressive reform. It doesn't take from the top of the income and wealth ladder within Colombia. Instead, it sort of takes from middle-class professionals, makes their pensions a little worse than they have been, and then gives a relatively modest but still, you know, meaningful pension to basically everybody else within Colombia, so the poorest. And so having a pension period is an important thing, and, you know, it's important to recognize the politics of it. I mean, that could be an important thing for progressive forces within Colombia to have a sort of victory and to have a little bit of a material base, but it's not a whole lot. It's not a huge pension at the bottom, and it's the in-between reform.
And what's he faced in the way of resistance from the right and from business interests?
He's faced really significant resistance. There was a bunch of struggles over the attorney general's office. He finally was able to appoint his own attorney general just in the last couple of months. And so there's a little bit more leeway there. The courts have actually been, you know, a major blockage. So probably the most progressive reform was this tax reform that passed at the end of 2022. And the tax reform was actually progressive. I mean, it really did take from the top. And sort of was redistributive. It had some, you know, impressive and important taxes on extraordinary profits within extractive industries, so oil and gas. But then the Supreme Court within Colombia in December 2023, so like a year after the reform, more or less, gutted this key provision of it. So basically it said, and it's complicated, it sort of gets into the technical weeds a little bit, but basically the law said that you couldn't, they couldn't double dip the extractive companies by taking the royalties that they were paying the government for these extraordinary profits. They would deduct that from the taxes that they owed for the year. And so the tax reform got rid of that. And then the Supreme Court said, no, actually, they can do that. And so that limited the progressiveness of the reform and also cost the state significant revenue that it was counting on because it was counting on this additional tax money from extractive industries. So that's part of the resistance. Another piece of the resistance is it's almost like you're getting back into the debates about the character of the capitalist state when you're looking at what Petro has been up against. But it's like baked into the state to prevent any type of real progressive change. And there's a really concrete manifestation of this called the fiscal rule, which originates in the early 2000s, but it was enacted in 2011 officially. And it basically is fiscal responsibility as the law of the land, where you have to have the government budget has to be within a certain level. You can't go spending beyond that. And it's a really rigid sort of framework. And they will get downgraded from credit agencies if they go beyond that. They'll be illegal. I mean, it's part of the law. So there's just all this sort of political and then international financial and regulatory pressure from the credit rating agencies to forced Colombia into this so-called balanced budget scheme. And so that's been really hard because Colombia can't have the type of spending that they need. So there's all sorts of ambitious initiatives that Petro has, and he's really hamstrung on the budgetary front.
The dogs of war in the background there are set up for my next question. How's he been dealing with the internal warring factions? I mean, there was a peace deal, but the country is not fully at peace, right?
No. So he has this policy called Total Peace, and basically what Total Peace means as a policy framework is that Petro will negotiate simultaneously with all the armed groups within Colombia. I believe that there's 8 different official armed groups, armed actors, sort of guerrilla factions. There's not just the FARC, which demobilized in 2016, but there's the ELN, or the National Liberation Army, which is one of the bigger ones. And then there's also criminal groups that are sort of negotiating with the government. and it hasn't worked. It has had some successes, but it certainly hasn't been a total success. So the biggest success, I would say, is that with the ELN, which is one of the biggest guerrilla groupings within Colombia, there was a one-year peace deal, which just expired earlier in August. And that held for the whole year. So there was a ceasefire agreement and there was this holding, but that expired and the head of the army has said, we're going to go after you guys again. And so there's pressure to renew it, but thus far they haven't renewed that deal. And beyond that, there's still just tremendous violence, tremendous lawlessness in huge swaths of Colombia, especially the sort of southwestern region. There's Cauca, the north of Cauca, Norte de Cauca. So there's various sort of regions within Colombia that are racked by armed conflict. They tend to be where indigenous and the Afro-Colombian population is most concentrated. There's a huge sort of internal displaced population. I think the Norwegian Refugee Council put the number at 5 million Colombians. And I don't know if that also includes the millions of Venezuelan refugees who are passing through Colombia, coming through the Darien Gap and trying to come north to the United States. But there's a huge number of Colombians who have been displaced by the war. So it's a really, really hard thing. I would say, though, that my answers are mixing because that's kind of how politics is working right now. Some of these things have been more successful in some ways, as though there's like there has been some progress. There are actual talks. There's been like negotiations on particular points. And one of the hallmarks of Petro's policy, including his peace policy, is a sort of quote unquote structural approach. So he's not just trying to do sort of, you know, let's lay down the arms, let's have peace. He also wants development. He also wants to sort of, you know, bring the government presence back into these areas, actually have some economic activity that are legal, because there's a huge amount of illegal mining. There's a huge amount of illegal extraction. There's a huge amount of drug trafficking that's going in a lot of these areas. And so Petro solutions are not easy solutions, which means they take a lot longer. But some of the folks I talked to when I was in Colombia in June doing some research were saying that he's not getting credit in the press. So that's what I wanted to bring up, that he's having huge bad press all the time. And that's one of the other ways that the ruling elite within Colombia are trying to prevent change, that anytime there's any minor problems, or even if there's moderate successes, they paint them in a negative fashion. And so people who are working on the peace plan say that it's hard. It's really, really hard. It's not an easy thing at all, but they feel as though they are sometimes making progress, but they're not getting credit for it based on the press. And they feel like part of it is that they don't have enough people to actually have a communication strategy and do the negotiations and everything else. So it could be that the sort of mismanagement of how to tell people within Colombia, but they face a really hard slog because the press is dead set against Petro and his agenda.
I'm speaking with the sociologist Gabriel Hetland, author of an article on Gustavo Petro's record as president of Colombia. Petro is very active on the foreign policy front, particularly on Palestine. What exactly has he been up to?
Yeah, he's been talking about Palestine for his whole presidency. So before, you know, he was elected in June 2022. He took office in August 2022, and he gave a speech at the United Nations in September 2022 and was talking about Palestine a year later when he gave another speech. This is before October 7th, so before the war on Gaza started, he was talking about Palestine. And so it's been a major issue that he brings up regularly, and he's been very strong on Gaza. He's criticized Israel and the United States policy with respect to the war on Gaza relentlessly. He has recently stopped shipping gas to Israel. I think they might have also stopped shipping coal. So they're, you know, trying to materially cut off Israel from having access to resources from Colombia. And this has opened up a certain degree of space. I'm not sure the positions of most other Latin American leaders. I don't think the other leftists are not quite as vociferous, but I think that overall within the Latin American left, there's a lot of criticism of what's going on there. And Petro has been in the lead on that for a very long time.
Now, you mentioned other members of this Latin American left, which reminds me that there has been something of a Pink Tide 2.0 recently, hasn't there?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think you can trace this to AMLO in Mexico. So Andrés Manuel López Obrador got elected in 2018. He's just finished. And I know you had a friend of mine, Edwin Ackerman, who talked about AMLO and his successor as well on your show recently. He's really popular in Mexico, but he's gotten, you know, not the best press outside of Mexico.
Well, the social conservatism is a problem for Northern Hemisphere leftists.
Certainly a mixed bag, but he's a big part of the left turn or the sort of Pink Tide 2.0. You can see the election of the MAS in 2021 in Bolivia after the coup in 2019. That's a part of it. Gabriel Boric in Chile. And, you know, Petro is part of that as well. And I think, you know, Petro and Colombia and Mexico are the particularly interesting cases because they weren't part of the first Pink Tide. So they're sort of unique in that they're only part of the Pink Tide 2.0.
Okay. And then climate. He's been active on climate, but that's a dicey issue given the country's fossil fuel endowment. So talk about those contradictions.
Yes, the climate is, I think, one of the things that Petro is most well known for internationally. So he came in and one of his speeches at the UN, I think he said similar things in, you know, his September 2022 and September 2023 speeches. He talked about how oil is more addictive than cocaine. Of course, Colombia is famous for the production of cocaine. And so Petro is going right after that issue. And so he pledged to stop new oil production within Colombia and to sort of push for a just transition, a just energy transition within Colombia. And Colombia is actually, in terms of electricity and renewable energy within electricity, I think they're already at like 70% or something. So they're doing pretty well on that and have been for a while. But the problem of transitioning and sort of moving away from producing oil is that Colombia is in a dicey sort of fiscal situation right now. They do not have big budget surpluses by any means. And so if they stopped producing oil, then they would be in a really even more difficult fiscal situation. And so they're getting a revenue from oil. They're also getting, you know, domestic energy production and domestic energy use that they get from some of that as well. There's a lot of talk about it, but it's been a really hard thing to move forward. And there, you know, what's interesting is that if you talk to environmentalists, if you talk to oil workers who have particular perspective on it, everybody's sort of with the idea of the energy transition, but they all think that it should be gradual. Even in more environmental types, some of them, I mean, you don't want to paint them all with the same brush, but some of them are saying Colombia shouldn't be taking the lead in stopping oil production, that it should be global north countries. It should be the United States. It should be Europe. The EU that should be really sort of taking the lead on that. And it is really hard because if Colombia stopped, I think they get around half of their export revenue from oil. And it's a major industry. They're not a petrostate per se. I mean, it's not as important as Venezuela or Saudi Arabia, but it is really important. And so just cutting that source off overnight would be a really challenging thing. So there's a discourse of it. There's a lot of plans. There has been a lot of solar farms, which means sort of lots of solar panels being put up in particular places. There's wind farms that are taking place off the coast, but a lot of those things are you know, challenging to move forward at scale and to move forward really quickly. And then some of the people I talked to about the nitty-gritty finance pieces of the climate finance within Colombia were saying that even in terms of oil production, so Petro has said, I want to stop new production and new exploration, that there hasn't been demand for that. And what I wasn't able to find out is that is the lack of demand related to Petro saying that there won't be new production, so people are just not coming, or there's a lull. There's a lot of existing contracts, and those are still going forward right now. So I think the climate thing is important. I mean, what the other thing that people I talked to in Colombia were saying is that just having somebody within the Latin American left who talks about climate change so seriously, who talks about a just transition, and who's really pushing for it is important. It's changing the discursive space. It's changing the political space. There's a difference between Petro and Lula. Lula doesn't have the same sort of end oil production discourse that Petro has, and certainly leaders of Venezuela, even Chavez, talked about climate change but wasn't talking about stopping oil production within Venezuela. So to have somebody like Petro who's talking about it is important and is creating a certain amount of space, but the progress on that has been very uneven. And part of it goes back to that fiscal rule that to get actual financing for green energy projects within Colombia is really challenging. Colombia is a dependent country. They're on the periphery. They're, you know, they're not in a position to just sort of do whatever they want. They don't have the resources to do that. And so it's a hard slog. It's really difficult.
In line with what you said earlier about his interest in structural transformations. He also emphasizes the fact that this just transition has to be done globally, the finance and the planning for it.
Yes, absolutely. And that's one of the areas that I think Petro has been trying to take the lead. I mean, he's talking about a new international economic order. I don't know that they're using that specific phrase, but that's what people in the finance ministry who I spoke to were talking about. They were saying that in order to make progress on this, we need that. You know, we need a totally new global financial system. And Colombia is engaged in discussions about trying to make that happen. It's not an easy thing. It's not something that's going to happen overnight. But they're talking with Germany, they're talking with Kenya, they're talking with the UN Economic Commission on Latin America and the Caribbean, the UN Economic Commission on Africa as part of these discussions. And so they're, you know, these are really big problems, but that is indeed what would need to happen. And Petro has pushed that conversation forward. That's different than saying they've had really concrete progress on it, but they're certainly opening up space to try to talk about some of these really challenging issues. And that reminds me, you know, just some of the other things that similarly, when you were talking about the sort of structural focus he has, he's done some like small things that he doesn't get a lot of credit for. But in La Guajira, which is in the northeast region on the border with Venezuela, one of the things that they've been trying to do is have piped water as opposed to water that comes on trucks. When you have water that comes on trucks, that gives a huge amount of influence to local politicians. You can have a lot of clientelism in terms of the distribution of water. And he's actually tried to move away from that and having piped water. And so that's one of the examples of the sort of structural reform that Petro has been talking about and actually putting in place that aren't huge headlines, you know, within Colombia or internationally, but he is doing these things. And I think that that's where he's making a difference, but it's really hard, but he is doing things very differently than previous leaders had done. And so I think it's important to recognize some of those things.
And then finally, he's got 2 years to go in his term, but he can't run for re-election. So what can he do in this remaining time? And are there any plausible successors?
People on the left in Colombia are pretty depressed about the 2026 election. There's a pretty widespread feeling that the right's going to be back in office, and Petro can't run for re-election. That used to be the case, and then that was sort of done away with by the conservatives, actually, in the late 2010s. And he has this hostile Congress, so he can try to push through some reforms. There's still some progress on a labor reform. It's not the most progressive, but it is, you know, pushing some important things in terms of wages and collective bargaining rights and some important labor rights legislation that has moved forward in some of the stages of the legislative process, and it hasn't passed yet, but it has some possibility. There's a very controversial health reform that, you know, that's actually the thing that broke the coalition in April 2023. That seems pretty stalled, but he's talked about that. Occasionally, he has talked about a constitutional assembly and trying to sort of do a new constitution within Colombia. That really freaks people out, partly because he had to promise that he wasn't going to do that and did say he wasn't going to do that. I don't think there's a lot of traction on that. I don't know that it could actually happen without Congress helping it to happen. And so it's probably something that's blocked. But just looking at it, sober analysis, it's going to be really hard for Petro in these final 2 years. But he's very energetic. He is a really hard worker. He's a creative thinker. So I'd say that he'll use all the tools available, and we'll see if he's able to sort of create some political openings. But I would say that people were pretty pessimistic, particularly about the 2026 election, and they weren't particularly optimistic about the next 2 years in terms of getting things through Congress. There was a sense that they might be able to get a few things through, but they'll be pretty compromised versions of some of the big reforms that he's pushing for. We'll see. The other thing I think that, you know, is going to keep moving forward is this total peace. And I think the people who are engaged in those negotiations are incredibly dedicated. I mean, I was able to sort of go to some panels. When I was doing my research, it was the Latin American Studies Congress in Bogota in June, and there was a bunch of panels on the total peace. And the people who are doing that are really, you know, they're really committed. They're really smart. And they were a little more optimistic than the newspapers would let you believe. And so it does feel like, you know, there could be some breakthroughs on that, but it's a really, really hard slog on so many different fronts within Colombia. So it's hard to be overly optimistic looking ahead.
So all in all, though, it sounds like pretty good considering.
Yeah, I think that that's a good assessment of things. And I think it's also, you know, even though leftists are a little bit pessimistic looking ahead, it's still incredible to have somebody like Petro in office. You know, just the way he talks about the armed struggle. Obviously, he comes from a guerrilla background, and so that's incredible to have that. He has an Afro-Colombian vice president, and so the sort of racism that, you know, has been a huge part of Colombian history has a different tenor, having an Afro-Colombian vice president. Just having somebody who's relentlessly criticizing, you know, the genocide in Gaza, and the somebody who's open. We haven't talked about Cuba and Venezuela, but he's established relations. He renewed relations with Cuba and Venezuela. He's been critical of Maduro in many ways and also trying to work with him. So he does a really interesting role on Venezuela that's pretty unique within the region. And I think that it's hard, but you don't want to underestimate just how important it is to have somebody like Petro in office. And then, of course, Petro himself is not perfect. I mean, people say he's on Twitter too much. He has an over...
I can identify.
He really does use Twitter quite a lot. And he sometimes he gets into, you know, these squabbles on Twitter that you're like, what are you doing, man? That's maybe not the best use of your political resources. But, you know, sometimes he'll open up conversations and things like that. And so he's just a really different type of leader than Colombia has had really any time in its history, but certainly in its recent history. I wouldn't underestimate the possibility of some interesting things happening in the next 2 years within Colombia. And if, you know, if the global economy shifts a little bit, maybe some of the climate stuff could also take off. I mean, I think that we didn't talk about it, but Colombia has been facing really high interest rates. So it's hard to be too optimistic about the global economy right now. But if there was a shift on that, Colombia could have a little bit more room for maneuver. Maybe if Harris was even more inclined towards climate than Biden, who knows? I mean, if she were to win. So having somebody like Petro gives you some hope that you wouldn't have if he wasn't there. I think we could say that.
That was Gabriel Hetland, Associate Professor of Latin American, Caribbean, and Latinx Studies at the University of Albany, and author of It's Hard to Be a Leftist Leader in Colombia on the Nation magazine's website. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of David Bowie's very early song, Memory of a Free Festival. Till next week, bye.